Go. I'm living in that 21st century, doing something mean to it. Do it better than anybody you ever seen do it. Screams from the haters, got a nice ring to it. I guess every superhero need his theme music.
Who the fuck is that guy?
No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop tripping, I'm tripping off the power.
Oh, well.
Hello. Okay, we're good.
All good?
We don't have the first those 6 minutes or whatever we just did where I just bitched and moaned about Facebook and nobody really would have given a shit. So, hey, everybody, welcome to MMA and stuff. We did 6 minutes at, I'll tack on to the end of this show because it's only me and that's all anybody really needs. I don't know what the fuck happened to Matt with it. Because for some odd reason the recorder wasn't working, but now it is working, and away we go.
So yeah, this past weekend, Saturday night, we had UFC Fight Night Barboza vs. Lee from the Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Attendance was 9,541 with a total gate of 923,720. You got to get that 720 in there. In the main event, in a catchweight fight at 157 pounds, we had Kevin Lee defeating Edson Barboza by TKO. It was actually doctor stoppage due to a cut, I think over like his left eyebrow, if memory serves me right. It was 218 in the fifth. Lee looked great in this fight. He claims he missed weight. He came in at 157 because he ran out of time, was his claim. He says he was going to make it, but he didn't have enough time to get there. He's known about this fight for months. I'm not sure how much more time he would have needed, but that was his excuse. In the end, it didn't really matter. I don't think the pound would have made any difference either way. Lee really just took Barboza down at will and beat him up on the ground and mauled him. And I don't want to say it was as impressive as the Khabib fight, but he looked really, really good. I'm still trying to figure out if it's a hole in Barboza's game or if Kevin Lee and Khabib are so much better at takedowns and wrestling on the ground than everybody else at 155, but nobody has ever really thrown Barboza around like this besides Khabib. And Lee just looked great. Like he would get mount, keep mount. You don't see guys get mounted at this level like that very often, just beat up. He was pinning Barboza's hand behind his head and then punching him with the other hand and just laid a beat down. There was one moment, I think, in the third or fourth where Lee got rocked, but he regained his senses and got another takedown and just really, really dominated this fight for 99% of it, except for that one head kick where he got wobbled.
Yeah, and that one head kick almost ended the fight for him. I mean, he was really screwed up there, but hey, dude, tough as nails, came back, fought through it, but I thought his overall his performance was the best Kevin Lee fight he's ever had, by far. It's not a one-off either, because he did something similar to Michael Chiesa and even Tony Ferguson to a degree. He has some of the best jiu-jitsu grappling I've seen in a while. Like he's very technical, very deliberate about his how he went about things, as you mentioned. His mount is, I haven't seen a mount like that in forever. It seems like he really embraces pinning guys with his hips or something, because he keeps you down, and he would pass well, and just, he could hit hard, too. Like, mm-hmm. A lot of guys also from the mount tend not to generate that level of force, and I think a lot of that's just they don't want to overexpose themselves, but Lee didn't seem to give a shit, because he was laying a beating on Barboza. It was very, I mean, Lee versus Nurmagomedov, as far as who did better there, that's a real tough one, just because it was kind of like a different style of fight. As far as like, I mean, it looks similar, but Lee would try to establish his position and really hold on top and pin and then punch. And you put a lot of energy into every punch, whereas, Khabib just never stopped hitting, and he just has naturally heavy hands. And I just watched Jim Miller get knocked out again. And plus, we don't, you don't know what it would have been like if Khabib had fought Brock Lesnar for five rounds either. He could have done the same thing, but.
True.
I didn't see Barboza. He didn't have that faraway look in his eyes like when Khabib fought him. But I mean, holy hell, man, Kevin Lee, he brought it and then some. I mean, this was a not that he wasn't a star, but this is like one of those fights where it really solidified him to me as, all right, this guy's a real deal because he's got the look, he's got charisma, he's young, and hell, if he can't fight like a motherfucker.
Did you hear any of him on a Rogan show?
No.
Yeah, they it was one of those, you know, Joe Rogan experiences where it was just solely MMA focused. And he interviewed Lee for, you know, I want to say almost like close to 2 hours. And he sounds like he's got his shit together. People, some people were turned off by the thing with Chiesa where he punched him and everything, but he sounds like he's got a decent head on his shoulders, and he's only 25. You're talking about that mix at lightweight now where you've got, you know, Conor, Khabib, Poirier, Eddie Alvarez, and who else is in there? Oh, Ferguson. He's like 5 years younger than most of those guys. It's like, to me, he's got the most potential. He debuted in the UFC 4 years ago when he was 21. These other guys... Jeez. You know, or pushing their early 30s, and it's like he's that might be that next generation guy that eclipses, you know, the guys we've been talking about the last 4 or 5 years as the best in the world at lightweight.
Yeah, and you know, he's lost to Ferguson and he got tapped, so it's not like you know, any fluke to it there.
Well, he also had the staff too. I mean, yeah, I don't know how much that would affect you and make you more likely to tap to a triangle that might not have been applied properly, but even so, I don't think he was 100% for that fight, and it was also the toughest fight of his career, where he went from Michael Chiesa to Tony Ferguson. I think there's a jump in quality of opposition there, but this Barboza fight, he dominated him, except for that one head kick. It was like, it wasn't even close this fight. And it's like, I see him doing the same thing to like somebody like Poirier. I see him taking Poirier down and beating him up the same way.
He's got a style that's going to screw with guys. And I was going to say, like, even though he's faced Ferguson, I do think against a lot of the top guys in that division, he'd be a handful. The staff infection, I mean, the fact that he's allowed to fight with staff is absurd enough. But like him against Conor, stylistically, I mean, it's like, yeah, that's a bad matchup. I mean, I always think that about everybody with Conor, though. But, no, he's right there, and unlike a lot of those guys, again, he's got personality, charisma. I hear that he's a good-looking man. I wouldn't know. I'm too straight to even really notice these things. But is everything else you could want in a drawing champion there? It's like, yeah. And, yeah, he's younger than the other guys, and... You know, he's healthy. He fights a lot. He's active. We'll probably be watching him for a couple of years now.
After the fight, he called out Khabib. He called out Khabib for, I think, a Chicago show or something. A recent card he was on, he wanted Khabib. There's not a lot of guys calling out Khabib. And I think that's pretty ballsy and shows the confidence he has. How do you see this all panning out? Because I know we've been talking about this for weeks on end, but you've got a log jam at lightweight with 5 or 6 really good guys who all kind of sort of have a claim to either an interim championship, the real interim championship, or number one contender. Currently, as things stand, Khabib is their recognized champion. According to the rankings, Conor McGregor is ranked number one. Number two is Tony Ferguson, who was interim champ and got stripped. Then you've also got Eddie Alvarez at 3, Dustin Poirier at 4, and Kevin Lee at 5.
Yeah, look, everything obviously depends on Conor. If he shows back up, it's Conor and Khabib. We have no idea what Conor's going to do, just if he's allowed in the United States ever again. Yeah, I don't know. But, you do that fight, obviously. And but if not, then you just do Khabib and Tony. And I think that,
Tony's supposedly out for like a year, is what they're saying.
Oh, is he really?
Well, I guess that LCL completely tore off the bone.
Things a little easier then.
That's the last I heard. That could
okay,
be.
Okay, well, that's
maybe it's like John Cena and he can heal super quick, but
Well, you never know. Then in that case, to me, it's obvious you just do Kevin Lee versus Dustin Poirier for a number one contenders fight.
And the winner fights Khabib.
I'm presuming Khabib fights Conor. It just seems like there's no way that doesn't happen now. Conor's if Conor wasn't gonna fight, I don't think he'd be doing a lot of this stuff, and he's not gonna box again. I don't think the money's gonna be there in boxing necessarily. And I think that him and Khabib, that's huge money now, and he's gotta do something. Look, he owes the UFC now because canceled half a fucking pay per view.
How about Eddie Alvarez? He's just screwed. He's coming off the Gaethje win, former lightweight champ, had the weird fight with Poirier, but he's like,
he doesn't want to fight. He won't fight Poirier. So that knocks him out. So the only person he could fight would be Lee, which I think he'd probably take because that seems the kind of fight Alvarez's brain would do. It's a good one. Otherwise, I'm not really. Let me look this up here if I can see my own rankings. I used to have them up earlier, but then I put it down.
The other guy floating out there, too, is Nate. I mean, Nate could fight any of those guys, too.
Okay, that's basically. Well, who the fuck knows with Nate? It's a Diaz. I mean, that's just so. And then, of course, there's always a Max Holloway fight. I know he's fighting Brian Ortega, but still. Nate.
Lightweight's awesome.
I guess Nate and Kevin Lee makes more sense than Nate and anybody else. Just because, one, stylistically, it'd be awesome. And the trash talk would be good. Like, you don't want to wait. You could headline like a pay-per-view probably with Nate and Kevin Lee. I don't think you could do it with Nate and Dustin Poirier. It just doesn't have the same sexiness.
I know. Yeah, I think Nate draws now. I don't think it matters.
I think Kevin Lee's just a bigger star than Poirier.
Maybe.
Think about like them talking trash and Kevin Lee and, he insults Michael Chiesa's mom. That's what he does. That's his claim to fame. And,
the best part was that Kevin Lee didn't even insult his mom.
I know. It was nothing. Chiesa lost his fucking mind over nothing. Weirdest shit I've ever seen. You're a grown-ass cage-fighting man. What are you getting so excited about, you bitch? That's right, you bitch. I got to update my rankings here. Although, because the last time I did rankings, apparently Poirier was at number 9. But there's 14 guys ahead of him that all have titles still. So, I don't know. Michael Johnson's out there. There's a fight they could do.
On the UFC site, Michael Johnson's not even ranked anymore. Felder, they got Felder, Anthony Pettis, Iaquinta, Chiesa, Gaethje, Barboza. Lightweight is the best division in the world, by far. So good. It's so good. There's so many good fights they can do. I was thinking about it the other day, why is that? And it's there's not a lot of guys smaller than that, guys who weigh, 145 or less. And then a lot of, the elite athletes, in the NBA or football or whatever, are bigger. There's not a lot of 155-pound linemen in the NFL or point guards in the NBA or hockey players or anything. So I think MMA gets better, smaller athletes because there's not a place for them in major league sports,
Oh, yeah. And also, you think of, a grown man. A grown man is a grown athletic man is probably about 190, 200 pounds, in that range, and that's basically a 155 pound fighter. When you're getting in shape and cutting and all that stuff, that's the guys who are really great athletes, but they're just physically too small for real sports.
You don't see a lot of guys who are 5'10" playing pro sports. You just don't.
The only one they do play is soccer.
Okay,
there's a lot of small
enough.
Dudes playing soccer. But again, even soccer, the pool, the kind of person that does it, it's a totally, come on. We're talking, that's one of the most physically passive sports versus the least passive sport you could dream of. Hey, you're going to run around for an hour and a half on the biggest field we've got, and if anybody even touches you, it's against the rules. Or you can get inside of a steel cage, and we're going to lock it. Like, I feel like those, like, the same mentality doesn't work for both of those. I know some, like, even the Brazilians. Like, all the Brazilians have fought in MMA over the years. There's not, like, a lot of these guys. Like, Jose Aldo gets to play some soccer growing up or whatever, but you don't hear, like, a lot of stories where, like, yeah, you know, I was a really good soccer player growing up. And it's like, no, most of these guys are just like, no, I've just been fighting my whole life. Like, I grew up on the streets, and that's the only way I could eat. So I just beat the shit out of other kids to get the last scraps. Sometimes I fought a dog, whatever I had to do to get some food.
It also explains why divisions like heavyweight and light heavyweight are so shallow, because most of those guys who are good athletes are going to play, you know, football, whether it's pro or college or whatever. They're going to be more focused on sports where size is important, and I think that's part of the reason there's such a lack of depth there, where you're like, oh my god, Shogun is still ranked in the top five, or Curtis Blaydes is the fourth ranked heavyweight in the world right now. You see stuff like that, and
plus,
it's like,
just this, like, plus just in general of the whole world population, most people are gonna, most men are probably gonna be, I'm guessing, you know, like about 5'8", 180-190 pounds, you know, like a dude that's 6'4" and 250 pounds, you know, yeah, if they're even a halfway decent athlete, they're doing some sort of other sport, because, it's like if you're 7 foot tall, you don't even have to be a good athlete, you're in the NBA. Like, they just draft guys from Lithuania who are like 7 foot three, who are skinny as shit, and nobody's ever seen them play basketball against anybody who's actually like a real basketball player, but they're just, but you know, you can't teach height. And so you just go with it. It's like, if you're a big fat guy, you're going to do sumo. That's just what you do. You don't have to worry about, like, you know, you're not competing with the sprinters of the world or anything. No matter how much you might like it, Takeshi.
In the semi-main event, Frankie Edgar defeated Cub Swanson by unanimous decision 30-27 on all three cards. Edgar just kind of darted in and out and landed some shots. Swanson didn't land as many. Nobody was really in that ever in danger. I don't think there were any takedowns, but Edgar got the win. I wouldn't say it was uncompetitive, but Swanson didn't do a whole hell of a lot, and I don't think anybody even remembers this fight happening at this point.
No, it's although I will say this is like the best possible outcome for me, because I kind of like both of them. And as I grow older and become more compassionate, you know, it's nice to see two dudes fight who I'm, like, scared for their health, but they didn't get hurt. Like, nobody really got beat up. I didn't have to see Frankie get clubbed over the head real hard. You know, Cub didn't take any real big shots. This kind of two dudes went out there and they fought, and they were in a fight. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it shortened their life by a good year or so, just because that's what cage fighting does, but... nobody got seriously maimed. That's all I ask for now.
Justin Willis defeated Chase Sherman by unanimous decision 29-28 on all three cards.
Yeah, Justin Willis kind of came in with a little bit of... people could tell, like, he's a heavyweight. So, again, like we just said, if you're a heavyweight in MMA, you're naturally a prospect. He's just got a little bit of... you know, a little bit of power, I guess. But again, he's a heavyweight. They all do. But he's kind of athletic. He doesn't look like he should be. But he looks kind of like Roy Nelson. But he does move pretty well. But he just couldn't put away Sherman. He dropped him hard in the first round. It should have been over. But Sherman's a tough dude. But eventually, Whitey lost.
Prior to that, we had David Branch defeating Thiago Santos by knockout. At 2:30 of the first round, big win for Branch coming off that loss to, you know, the surfer boy, Luke Rockhold. Branch is, I think, kind of underrated. He's older. I think he's 35 or 36 now, but he was WSOF, like, middleweight champ, light heavyweight champ, and obviously that's a lower class of fighters, but David Branch isn't bad, and Santos is a good middleweight. I think he was on a 3 or 4 fight win streak going into this fight. So a good win for Branch got him back on the winning track.
Yeah, and that's fine. It's David Branch. He's just going to exist in the world. He's going to go out there. He's going to have these big, fancy knockouts, and I won't remember a fucking moment of it. By the way, speaking of Luke Rockhold, I saw some like random thing on Twitter, I think, or whatever, some rumor, but like, the UFC might do Luke Rockhold versus Alexander Gustafsson for an interim light heavyweight championship. And while I don't know if that'll happen, I couldn't believe it. I didn't realize that, of course, they're going to do an interim light heavyweight championship. Like, there's no way they won't. The only reason, the only holdup is they got to find somebody to fight for the damn thing. And your highest profile light heavyweight fight coming up is, like, you know, Shogun versus Voltron. And that'd be a hell of an interim title fight.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too promising. But I guess with Cormier tied up fighting Stipe, we're due for an interim champ, yeah. I'm still curious when we're going to hear about John Jones and what USADA has decided. That was last July. It's been, you know, 9 months now, and we still have no word on what John Jones' punishment will be. In a bantamweight fight, Aljamain Sterling defeated Brett Johns by unanimous decision, 30-27 across all three cards. Johns was undefeated going into this fight and had a little bit of hype behind him, but it looks like he may have been overhyped.
Yeah, look at that. A guy from the England country there, England, Ireland. Well, he's Welsh, but that's English. It turns out they're not that good.
Dan Hooker defeated Jim Miller with a flying knee, essentially. This was sad.
This is huge, man. Hooker might be. I don't know if he's legit.
He's pretty good.
He's very good. As I'm saying that, I'm now rewatching Kevin Lee and Barboza. I'm like, yeah, Hooker's good and all, but he ain't close to this level yet. I'm not getting that. Like, he's the Kevin Lee, but. And I think some of it's because he's kind of got, he's from New Zealand. He reminds me of Stephen Thompson. Mm-hmm. He's kind of karate looking, and he just like, he doesn't look like that athletic, and he's white. Like, I'm just not going to, I don't see a lot of upside on unathletic looking white dudes.
He's got 3 wins in a row now. He beat Ross Pearson, Mark Diakisi, and Jim Miller now, so. You'd like to see him maybe get a top 15 guy now, but good win, spectacular finish, knocked him out and landed one nasty punch to his face, and it was a sad day for Jim Miller. It might be time for Miller to hang up the boots, even though you don't really wear boots in a cage fight.
Hang up the gloves, Miller, but he should have been retired many fights ago.
He's lost 4 in a row now. Poirier, Pettis, Francisco Trinaldo, and now Dan Hooker.
I mean, he should. I remember thinking before he fought Lozon that second time, and it was like a December show. I remember thinking before that show, I want to say late 2015, maybe, or no, 2013. I don't know, but I remember thinking maybe 2014. I was in
the second Lozon fight.
Yeah, it was
that
in
was
December.
16. It was August 27th, 16.
Did they fight in December ever?
You gotta look. The original fight was in December, December 29th, 2012.
Okay, that's the one I'm thinking of then. I remember thinking that during that fight that he should be retiring. Fuck, that was 2012! Jeez.
Sounds like Diego.
And here's the thing, though. You look at him since 2012. Has Jim Miller done anything that would make you think, it's a good thing he kept fighting for another 6 years?
Well, it's weird. He went on a weird streak in 16 where he beat Gomi, Lozon, and Alves. And granted, they're not elite guys, but he had a 3-fight win streak there. And I think he was always claiming part of his issue was where it was the Lyme disease. He got Lyme disease. And that supposedly has fucked him up, and he's on. I saw a picture of him with like a bag of pills he's got to take every day. Like, he's not healthy, and I think that's part of the problem. He's 34. Granted, that's old in MMA years, but I think Jim Miller, and I'm thinking he's like 38, 39 at this.
So, yeah, I thought so too. Yeah,
I mean, he debuted in the UFC back in 2008, and he was 11-1 at the time when he debuted, and now he's 28-12.
Hey, so athletic commissions, if a dude has to take, like, a giant bag of pills every day for his Lyme disease, maybe he's not medically cleared to fight. Maybe. Just maybe. Throwing that out there.
He's gone 17-11 in the UFC.
That's an absurd record.
And his last
17-11.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
He's 4-8 in his last 12, though. So yeah, he's slipping. He's older. He's got Lyme disease. Don't let deer ticks bite you, is my advice.
I take that. That's good advice. I live my life that way.
Let them bite your puggle, though. Who cares? On the prelims, we had Ryan LaFleur defeating Alex Garcia by unanimous decision, 30-27 on all three cards. This fight was not good.
I don't remember it.
Ricky, don't call me Simon, Simone, defeated Mira Dvizhili by technical submission. It was a guillotine choke.
Oh, there we go.
At 5 minutes of the third round. I think I even messaged you. I'm like, this is a really good fight. It was competitive, but I had Dvizhili winning the first two rounds. He was just taking Simone down and landing better shots and was just the better fighter, I thought. And then you got to, like, maybe 45 seconds left in the third, and Simone got a guillotine on and rolled it over, got mount, and was cranking this thing, like, twisting his head. And Dvizhili was, like, trying to show that he was okay. At one point, he gave a thumbs up and was, like, bicycle kicking his legs to show that he wasn't out. But it was really tight, and it was really close. And the horn sounded, the bell sounded, and then so Simone let go of the guillotine, and Dvizhili was out of it. Like, he was totally stunned, didn't know where he was, kind of was, like, staggering around. And it was decided afterwards that it was a technical submission, which I don't think I've ever seen that happen in MMA, and I've watched, you know, thousands of fights at this point. So I was very confused. I was under the impression if the horn sounded and the ref didn't stop it, the fight was over, but apparently that's not how it works.
I mean, we've had technical submissions before. That's when the guy doesn't tap,
mm-hmm.
and the referee stops. Like, you know, Mir and Tim Sylvia and shit like that. I guess that'd be technical submissions, but...
Or the guy goes to sleep.
Yeah, you know, but this is, I mean, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It should be impossible. Like, the closest I guess we've ever seen to something like this was UFC 34, I think it was. 34 or 36? 35, maybe. In that range. When BJ Penn fought Jens Pulver for the first time. And Penn had an armbar at the end of the second round, and he's cranking it. And, like, he's got the position, he's ready, and he just as he finally falls back and extends the arm and it gets locked out, the bell rings and then Pulver taps right away. And so it's like, what, did that count? No, it didn't count because a submission isn't putting yourself, it's not just like wrapping your arms around the guy's head and choke him, right? You have to actually choke the guy. You can't just put your arms there and it submits him. So, like, you know, the act of submitting someone, there's like a tipping point when the technique is applied and it submits him. I don't think the Moab or whatever, Mirab, I don't know, Mirab was submitted. Like, I gave him a lot of credit for kicking his legs. Because when he first started doing that, it looked kind of like he was tapping. Because I've seen guys tap with their feet like that. I'm like, what?
Well, like if your hands are tied up. Like if you can't physically tap for whatever reason. But
no, but he was doing it to show that he was
free, like, he had a free hand.
And he was doing it to show that he's still there. And I was like, you know what? I give him a lot of credit. I thought that was smart. And he kept kicking his legs until the bell sounded. And then he was there. He may have been stunned. He may have been wobbly. But guess what? That's not a reason to stop a fight. The guy looks a little wobbly. Well, it's not from a punch. It's from being, you know, being kind of his head squeezed. But he wasn't out cold. Like, the name of the sport is, when it comes to a submission, either it works and the guy taps, or it works and the referee stops it. Because the referee has decided that it is too dangerous for the guy to continue fighting. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't stop it because he goes, hey, you got the arm bar. No, because, you know, we've seen guys lock out arm bars, but they don't have the thumb pointing up or whatever it may be. I used to do that, like, you know, somebody doesn't know what they're doing with an arm bar. They give it to them. If your thumb's not pointing the right direction, you can go all day and you won't get tapped. It looks like it should hurt, but it doesn't. And people get really frustrated because they go, well, why isn't it working? Well, yeah, you just because you get the hold on, it looks like it, it doesn't count. You either tap somebody, or the referee affirmatively decides this is a danger to his health to continue. There's no, like, you know, you got knocked, like, this isn't boxing, where, you know, you have to answer the 10 counts and shit like that, like the bell can't save you. Like, if he was unconscious when the bell sounded, the referee should actually lose his job, because that means he didn't protect the fighter.
Right.
He didn't, you know, he was an incompetent referee, and it doesn't appear that he was, because his feet were fucking moving. You know, don't give me that he looked glassy-eyed or whatever. Like, he did the right thing. He wasn't getting hurt. The way, how do you defend a choke? You defend the choke. And if it doesn't work, it's not like you could, like, well, the fight stopped. Why? He kept trying to choke for a long time. The other guy wasn't doing anything. Now, he wasn't being choked, but that guy looked like he was trying it a lot, so we stopped the fight. Now, it doesn't fucking work that way.
Would you like to hear John McCarthy's thoughts on it?
Sure.
Well, it was funny because when they announced the winner, they called it a TKO. It definitely was not a technical knockout. It was a technical submission. So McCarthy had an issue with that, but he went on, trust me, Mirab went out twice. First time when he slammed his head into the mat on the takedown at 56 seconds left, then on the neck crank at the bell. At the 56-second mark, the fighter is knocked silly if not out by his own takedown. That is why Simone moves to mount and the neck crank so easily. At the end, the fighter is out for a second, therefore he has been submitted and loses as such. It should never be ruled as a TKO. Saved by the Bell was a shitty sitcom and a term that is associated with old boxing. It does not apply to this, an MMA with submissions. Man was out at the bell and several times before. Why is it you want someone to win a fight when they were submitted?
Because he... Okay. The word is submit. Submit. You have to submit yourself. Somebody can't submit you. You submit to someone. It's in the fucking word itself. This is language. And this isn't just, you know, this isn't me being pedantic. Like, that's what it actually means. Now, if you want to say that he... Now, if somebody wants to argue that he was actually knocked out, that I could see. In a weird way, he may have knocked him out. In a really, like, slow way. He kind of pushed... He punched the blood vessel. I don't know. The referees are just like cops. They're going to bend over to defend themselves.
Well, I think Mirab there is going to appeal the loss. Do you think he will get anywhere with his appeal?
No.
No. That never seems to work.
They never do the right thing. They're just cowardly bureaucrats. And, you know, when the revolution comes... And I'm blaring Kanye is our war cry. I'm going straight for the fucking Athletic Commission.
It's the new national anthem.
Damn right.
This is what DeVischelli told old Ariel Helwani on the MMA Hour. I just feel like they took a win from me because my opinion, I think I won. I won the fight. I never tapped. I never was choked. I don't know what's happened. I don't have an answer for what's happened. I never tapped. I was still in. I was just waiting for my time. When time's finished and that's it, I won it. I was winning the whole fight. I was conscious for the fight.
You know, I was thinking, Big John, I once watched a fight, and I know the pay-per-view, this was the UFC 37, when Murilo Bustamante beat Matt Lindland. And you were the referee, John. And in that fight, Bustamante armbarred Matt Lindland, and Matt Lindland actually tapped out, and he still got to keep fighting. That was a case where a guy actually did submit to his opponent. He said to his opponent, I submit myself to you. I quit. And you said, eh, keep going. So fuck you guys. Mirab is a hero. And he's been jobbed out of this. We need justice for Mirab is what we need.
Yes. That will surely be trending on Twitter after this show. Sayer Bahadurzada defeated Luan Chagas by knockout, kick to the body, and punch at 2:40 of the second round. I did not see this fight.
I did, now that you said what happened there at the end, I remember it. He kicked him right in the stomach, and, like, it was like one of those sad things, and I've talked about it before. When you see the toughest human beings in the world just double over and want to start crying from pain, that's how awful these liver shots are. This poor son of a bitch got hit right there, and he kind of stopped. He backed up. There was like a split-second pause. You saw his hands go down, and they went down over the midsection in that way where, like, you don't want to touch your skin because it hurts so much. Like, you just know that his skin, like, felt like it was fire. Fire and, push pins in your skin just all at once. And, like, as he's doing this, Sirha Badahazari walks up and just punches him in the head. And the dude goes down, and I don't know if he went down from the punch of the head or if he's going to be going down anyways, but damn, it just seemed... It wasn't, like, horrible, per se, but it sure did have, like, that air of, like, when Krokop punched Alberto Del Rio in the head. When it was just... Clearly, he just punched him, just like, yeah, fuck you, I can do this. Like, you dickhead, you're... What asshole fights with a mask on? I'm going to punch you in the face for this, you dumbass.
Yeah. He was even a dumbass back then, huh? At least he stayed consistent. In the opener on Fox Sports 1, Corey Anderson defeated Patrick Cummins by unanimous decision 30-26, 30-26, and 30-27.
That sucked.
Fight either. I heard like Anderson was just taking Cummins down whenever he felt like and like wrestling him, which you would have thought it would have been the opposite way.
That's exactly what happened, and it sucked. The only good thing in the fight was Patrick Cummins' mustache.
Oh, good.
Good mustache. Very Don Fry-like look, although he had like a completely shaved head. So it was kind of like if Don Fry fucked Mr. Clean.
Don Fry fucked Mr. Clean. Okay. In the opener fight pass, Tony Martin defeated Keita Nakamura by unanimous decision. Fight of the night went to Ricky Simone versus Mirab Dvshili, and performances of the night went to David Branch and Sayer Bahardizadeh.
What does Kevin Lee need to do? I mean, he should have got something.
He gets to fight Khabib next.
There's a prize.
One thing we didn't mention was Leslie Smith. She was scheduled to fight Aspen Ladd on the show. Ladd came in 2 pounds overweight, and Smith offered to take the fight if the UFC would extend her contract one more fight. The UFC counteroffered by declining that and just offering to pay her show and win bonus, which totaled $62,000, and now she is a unrestricted free agent. This is interesting.
So get those phone calls going there, Bellator. You're going to want that hot prospect.
Well, it's interesting. Smith was, I think, ranked in the top 10, had won 2 fights in a row at 135, and usually had decent fights, like whatever. But... the interesting part of this is that she is like the de facto president of Project Spearhead, which is basically an association, an effort to unionize fighters in the UFC. And the UFC basically just paid her never to fight again in the company and aren't interested in re-signing her, which isn't the best look considering it's like she's won a couple fights and they... could have said, yeah, sure, take the fight, and we'll re-sign you, win or lose, no big deal, whatever, we'll give you an extension. They didn't even do that. They just canceled the fight and paid her, and now she's out of the company, which I guess they're entitled to do, but Smith claims they're not, and she's taking them to court. She said, it's my opinion that what the UFC did was illegal, because they have created a situation where it encourages a climate of fear where the other people in the UFC on the roster are going to be fearful of publicly organizing and standing up for their rights. By creating a climate of fear that violates federal law, that's the whole point of the National Labor Relations Board and the laws that are in there. Smith said
she might have a case.
She's working with Lucas Middlebrook, who was the Diaz attorney that you liked back in the day. She said she was surprised that the UFC parted ways with her. I think that it opens up an examination of how they feel about my activities in organizing the fighters recently. I think by doing unusual behavior, it's going to ask, what are the unusual circumstances leading to this? So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I think it's a bad look on the UFC's part. You know, when Dana is worth probably $500 million now, the company sold for $4 billion, and they've got this potential deal with ESPN and Fox or whatever it is, ESPN and ABC, whatever it is, that's going to pay them, you know, $320 million a year. It's like, you could be paying the fighters a little more. Maybe try and get Leslie Smith on your good side and negotiate with her as opposed to
That'd be the worst idea ever.
I'm saying they're making enough in profit where they could pay the fighters more. I mean,
if they want to pay the fighters more, the moment you're ever in the black by a penny, you can always pay the talent more.
True.
But, I have no problem with paying the fighters more. I think some of these guys especially deserve more than what they're getting. But if they were to ever negotiate with her, that'd be the worst idea ever, because that's, you know, giving her that's, you don't create the union on your own. You make them do it. You know, you don't help somebody unionize, because unionization will cut into their profits and it will change things dramatically.
Right.
So,
but don't you think from like a PR standpoint, like going
no, they
about
have nothing
this,
to get, this one. It's cage fighting. Mm-hmm. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares about athletes and unionization anyways, because no one's sympathetic towards pro athletes. Even if they may be morally justified, like, people are just going to look in and they're going to be like, you're Leslie Smith, and I thought this, and I do think this now, who the fuck was giving you 60 grand to fight anyways? Like,
I think she came because of that cyborg deal. The cyborg deal is where she got that money, and she probably deserved it, taking Cyborg on short notice in Brazil. It's like, okay.
And that may be why, and that may be part of the reason why they gave her money. It may be as simple as she said, hey, extend my contract by one more fight or something like that, guarantee it, but they would have guaranteed it at that rate. It may just be as simple as somebody's looking at their books going, Leslie Smith is overpaid. Like, for where she's at, she should be at 20 and 20 instead of, and that should be creeped up to 40-40. I mean, it really could be that. That'd be the only... Here's the thing. I hope, if for the UFC's sake, I hope that's the case. Because otherwise, there is something there when it comes to how the NLRB will view letting her go. Like, if it seems like they really are trying to just get her out of the company because of her attempted unionization, they really could be in big trouble. Like, that would be... But it would be stupid. Like, it would be so dumb that I can't imagine that an attorney would see this and let it go. Although, then again, who knows who's really doing this shit sometimes. But also, I still can't believe Dana White would actually know, who Leslie Smith is, or what she's doing as far as trying to unionize. Like, all she does is tweet people. It's kind of sad when I see these tweets going by, like, hey, send your card so-and-so, and it's like, come on, this ain't going to work. You're Leslie Smith.
She's gonna probably
use this and become the next Bjorn Rebney.
If you were, you know, a lower-level, mid-level UFC fighter, and you felt, you know, everybody deserved more money or whatever, better treatment, to be classified as employees, whatever, what would you do? What's your recourse? Like, at least she's trying. She's doing something, right?
The thing is, that's not how anybody thinks, nor should they think. People don't think we should all be getting more. They think, what will get me more? People only join a union because it benefits themselves. If people can't get something out of doing it, like, if you can't tell a guy you will make more money, they're not going to do it. So you have to convince people that it's be in their best interest. And I think the nature of combat sports is it's always going to be very difficult to do that, because it is a sport that by definition requires you to think that you are better than everybody. Like, the only way you win is if you think you are exceptional. And exceptional people unions only don't work for exceptional people. Exceptional people get fucked by a union. Exceptional people get held back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like LeBron James would be making five times what he makes right now if it was a completely free market in the NBA. But he loses some of that for the union and blah, blah, blah. I mean, he's not crying or anything like that. So I think fighters are just naturally going to see themselves as exceptional. And again, they have such short careers anyways. You're going to tell some guy, hey, you gotta go on strike for like a year or whatever. Like that's like a third of most guys' professional careers. Plus, it doesn't matter. They can throw out almost anybody. It'll draw. All they need is Conor. You got Conor McGregor and, you know, 14 drunk Irishmen you found in a bar, and you do a million buys in pay-per-view. And Leslie Smith, you better realize that. You are as valuable to the world as drunkards from Ireland.
I guess, what about the other 480 fighters, though? Like, the guys who are getting 12 and 12, that sort of thing. Like, to me, it's
they're
like
not doing
these,
it.
No, those guys are all, these
they're
other
all
bigger.
So grateful to, but they're so grateful. Those guys in the low end, they've just hit their dream. They're in the UFC and they're making $25,000 if they win. Right. And these guys are almost universally they're going to be 18, 19, 20 year old guys. You know, they're all young people who come from pretty much nothing, anyways, and. It's a fantasy job. You know, it's one thing to unionize for a job you don't like. If you're unionizing as a coal miner, because nobody dreams of being, I can't wait to work in the fucking coal, in the coal mines, and die at 40 from a cave-in, or if I get the black lung. Like, you know, you would sit there and go, yeah, fuck this, I don't want to do this shit. But if you're a 20-year-old, and you get to be on pay-per-view beating people up, and you get to be a star, it's just, I'm not saying they shouldn't be unionized. I'm not saying it wouldn't be to their benefit. But the mentality of people, I just don't see it when it comes to combat sports. I just don't think it's ever going to happen.
Yeah, it's weird. Just because it seems like it's been beneficial for every other major sport. And granted, those have been around a lot longer. And I think that's part of the issue. Maybe 10 years down the road, things change. But the company, UFC, is getting bigger, and it's worth more money, and to me it's like I think it eventually happens just because you've got it in the NBA, NFL, you know, all the major league sports has it, and I think all the players are paid a lot more now than they would be otherwise. They're getting 50-50 splits in revenue, and it's like the UFC, it's nowhere near that, you know?
Oh, no, yeah, again, they would benefit, but keep in mind, again, those are sports. You know, MMA really isn't a sport. It is just hyping up random shit here and there.
Yeah,
you're not watching a season. Like, it's easy to boycott the season and things like that. Plus, I think that the other sports have all benefited so tremendously because baseball did all that. And baseball is so unique in that it's one of the few major sports where you play all the time, so you can always go on strike. It's an American institution. And guys can have 20-year-long careers. So you can tell yourself, I'm going to sit out for 2 years and boycott this shit because I'm going to get a lot of pay later on. Like the NFL, they basically don't even have a union. Like they got a little bit because the average career is like 3 years. Basketball kind of unique. I think it's just because of the predominance of black people, it's going to be a little more woke. But even basketball, I have no idea on basketball, to be honest. And hockey, I don't know shit how hockey works. And then I know that they canceled the season once, which that was a smart one. Hockey doesn't make any sense. Fucking Canadians. Like, how Canadians not just naturally figure this out? They're just all nice. They should have just come together. And it's probably because they got all the damn Americans involved owning shit.
If you
see where the German workers in, like, Germany Amazon are bitching? They don't want to have to work so much. Like, these American companies expect us to work all these hours just like the Americans do. It's like, yeah, you pansies. Like, doesn't anybody in the world just want to work? Fucking German. I say this as a guy who basically sits on the computer all day fucking around on the internet. But still, show a little work ethic, people.
Yeah, see, I do consider you a very hard worker. Two guys who can go back to work now are Junior Dos Santos and Antonio Rogério Nogueira. They were suspended by USADA temporarily, apparently. Both guys received reduced six-month suspensions by USADA after an investigation into two Brazilian pharmacies confirmed they were selling contaminated supplements that led to failed drug tests. Both Dos Santos and Lil Nog tested positive for the banned substance hydrochlorothiazide with, the USADA release stated that the compounding pharmacies located in Rio and Sao Paulo were preparing medication on-site and claimed to manufacture nutritional supplements without the possibility of cross-contamination, but when tested at the WADA-accredited lab in Salt Lake City, the supplements taken by all three fighters came up contaminated for multiple banned substances. Another guy, Rogério de Lima, also failed the test for anacetrazole. I guess there are three guys who were taking stuff in Brazil and somehow the supplements were all tainted. So now they're free to fight again.
I love that basically the sporting world has accepted, and possibly justifiably so, the defense of, we're from a poor country, shit happens here. Because that's all this is. We know it doesn't fly in America. The old contaminant, well actually I say that, but John Jones' dick pills kind of flew, didn't it?
He got the full suspension.
That's true, he did get the full suspension, even though he said he didn't. Yeah, that's right. So I don't know what the hell they're saying. This is so stupid. Like, look, I know the guys aren't really they are to blame because they're all cheating. They just got caught on this one. Stop taking shit. Real medicine doesn't come in like brightly colored bottles. They put it in like a weird orange one so that everyone knows this is medicine. Like, real medicine doesn't try to sell you on it, but I actually just went from a Viagra commercial to a Bud Light commercial, so they kind of do. But, it's like, the guy shouldn't have any suspension. They didn't do anything wrong. Either they get suspended for 2 years, or they should get nothing. I hate this shit where guys are getting in trouble when USADA says, yeah, we know you didn't mean to do anything wrong, but we still have to punish you. Because this will count, because the second time will be their second strike, as opposed to their first strike, which is bullshit. These guys are getting punished because they were victims. They were drugged. What they are is like date rape victims, and USADA is the cops saying, you shouldn't have gone out to that party. That's a good analogy, actually. That really works. I'm pretty fucking smart.
Yeah, don't put it on Facebook. Dos Santos said, I'm relieved that this nightmare is finally over and that we were able to determine what happened and where the prohibited substance found in my sample came from. Like I've always said, I'm a clean athlete. The most important thing now is that I can go back to earning my livelihood. I want to get back inside the octagon as quickly as possible. Back to business.
Hey, at least I guess somebody else at heavyweight. Also, I hope that Little Nog takes this as a sign and just should stay not fighting. Because like everything I said about Jim Miller has applied to Lil Nog for about like literally 12 or 15 years at this point. It's been a long time that this man should not have been fighting.
Lil Nog is reportedly 41 years old now.
I mean, and in Brazilian cage fighting years, that's like 79. Plus, he's got like late onset Alzheimer's. Like, this is not going. The Nogueira brothers' lives do not end well. No matter what people think, those two have a shitty end of life. And it's going to probably be a 5 or 10 year deal. And it's just going to be a lot of them sitting there, staring at things, shitting themselves, with people coming by and being like, I remember he used to be a great cage fighter. And they're like, yeah. And now look at him. He'll be like in some sort of hospital ward with linoleum floors, no air conditioner, just a fan going, like in the window. You kind of smell the ocean, but it's kind of a polluted ocean because, you know, this is the same country that was too polluted that had part of the Olympics in the fucking ocean. And people are just coming back, he used to be somebody, like, yeah, really? A big yep. And then the kids will fly away on a hover bike and he'll just stare and drool.
We haven't heard much from John Jones since his beef with Tyson Griffin on Twitter a couple weeks ago, but he's back. No news on his next suspension, but he has been going back and forth with Alexander Gustafsson and Daniel Cormier on Twitter. Gustafsson wrote on April 19th, "While others are talking about retirement, I just signed my new deal with the UFC today." Daniel Cormier wrote back, "Alex, what exactly have you accomplished in your career? I've earned the right to retire on top. Your greatest accomplishment is two close losses. Congrats on the new contract. Now go fight. It's been 2 years. Enough with the social media. Hashtag go fight."
Do you think that Daniel Cormier actually appreciates that? Because I don't think he does. I think he's genuinely stupid enough that he does not understand that Daniel Cormier insulting someone by saying your career highlights were two close losses is one of the funniest fucking things I've ever heard in my life.
Well, he did beat Gustafsson in a close fight.
And Gustafsson had some good wins, too.
I understand. Then John Bones replies, "I don't even like DC, and I enjoyed this. Too funny. Alex, bring all your tough guy shit to the championship rounds next time."
Yeah, that's good stuff. Poor Alex, just getting battered.
Literally and figuratively. And then, let's see. Gustafsson wrote back, crying smiley face laughing emoji, "Coming from you, man, being tough is going true the champ." What? "Being tough is going true the champ rounds without the good stuff. Now step up and I'll show you." So that's a veiled reference to Jones being on steroids, obviously. John Jones wrote back, "Brilliant comeback, just what I expected from you. I guess Shogun, Rampage, Bader, etc. could all use the same excuse now, too. Do you look yourself in the mirror and call yourself champ now that I cheated? Please tell me you convinced yourself that I was on steroids during our fight. Please tell me you convinced yourself I was ever on steroids," Jones wrote. He also said, "The only good stuff I used to send you packing was my big old American balls. Try spending a little more time here. Maybe you'll learn a thing or two."
I love when Jones talks about his balls and his dick. Like, he's always just throwing his cock and balls into his insults. And it's so perfect.
So, what John Jones has been up to. Did you ever see the clips of him on, I think it's Instagram, just randomly once every, like, 3 weeks? There'll be a picture, like, video of him, like, Bob Marley playing in the background and him in his garage with Brandon Gibson just, like throwing punches. It's the best thing ever. And, like, it's, like, clear he, like, never trains, except when he does, he has somebody film it and put it on Instagram. It's really good.
John Jones is a special human being, and we should all enjoy this.
I do.
Again, like a lot of guys in this business, his story ain't going to end well. Like, John Jones is not turning it around. John Jones is going to jail for real or something with cocaine. It's definitely cocaine because that boy has not stopped doing it.
In other news, Matt Serra is going into the UFC Hall of Fame.
Hey, I always thought, I've always said, kind of like, I don't think that the MLB Hall of Fame is always legitimate because Pete Rose isn't in it. Same deal with Matt Serra in the UFC Hall of Fame. You know, just if Matt Serra's not in, how can we take it seriously?
Rumors are next year Nick the Tooth is going in.
Wait, seriously?
No. I'm just naming my friend Dana.
Hey, you're joking around, but why not? Yeah, he's a friend of Dana. He could go in.
Nick the Tooth hasn't been around much the last year or so. I haven't seen him anywhere.
He had the falling out where he got pissed at Sarah and all them or whatever.
Okay. I missed that storyline, unfortunately. Here's a headline from MMA Fighting. Despite legal hurdles, Volkan Ozdemir's team confident he'll be able to travel to Germany for Shogun Hua fight. If you remember back, he was scheduled to fight Shogun in Chile, and the fight was canceled because they would not allow Ozdemir in the country because he's got legal matters to settle in the U.S. stemming from a bar fight he was in a few months ago. But apparently they think he can get into Germany okay.
Yeah, I bet I can see that happening because he's Swiss by nationality, and the EU allows the free travel of workers and shit like that. So he may be able to just walk right into Germany and be like, nope, part of the European Union. Doesn't matter if I've been beating the shit out of people in bars everywhere else. If you guys are going to let in a million Syrians, I get to come in too.
Why not just have the fight in the States where he lives currently?
Clearly the UFC recognizes the international drawing appeal of Volkan Oezdemir.
And Shogun really gets a bum deal on this. He went from fighting like the next country over, you know, Brazil to Chile, and now he's going to fight in Germany.
And Volkan gets to go from fighting across the world to the next country over, basically.
I think he lives in Florida now.
I know, but whatever. It's still the same.
Okay, fair enough. Sorry. Goddamn facts. Mr. Oezdemir's attorney would have to file a motion requesting that his client be allowed to travel, according to Broward County State Attorney Christy Grimm. No motion has been requested as of now because the belief on Oezdemir's team's side is that the trial will be concluded before the light heavyweight fighter has to leave for Germany. It's anticipated that his case will be concluded prior to that time.
When is the fight in Germany supposed to be?
The fight in Germany scheduled for July 22nd.
Yeah, I mean, criminal cases like this tend to move much faster than like civil cases, and I assume he's just going to get some sort of plea deal on a supervision or something like that, and away we go. He's still probably, regardless of the outcome of the trial, or the outcome of the case, I should say, he's still going to probably need permission to leave the country, but, I'm sure they'll get it. Well, I mean, it's just, all he has to do is look at them and be like, look, what's the worst case scenario? I abscond and never come back to the United States? Like, is justice going to really be so horribly thwarted? We're like, oh no, it's just as bad as Roman Polanski escaping justice for anally raping a 13-year-old. People will be like, eh, we got rid of Volkan Oezdemir. Big deal. Frankly, we should be going out of our way to kick out our violent immigrant. Like, come on, Trump, what are you doing here? He's stealing American jobs and he's committing violent crimes. Come on.
On the topic of UFC Chile on May 22nd, another fight has fallen off the card. Santiago Ponzinibbio has been forced to withdraw due to injury. Now Kamaru Usman has no one to fight. This is kind of a rough deal for that show because Ponzinibbio, I think, is from Argentina, maybe?
I think so,
anyway,
yeah.
He was supposed to be the South American draw in Chile, and now you've lost Shogun and Ponzinibbio. So I think they're trying to find a replacement for Usman, but Usman only wants to fight a ranked opponent, and it doesn't look like there's a lot of ranked welterweights left to fight, so that card could be cursed.
I mean, I wouldn't mind traveling to Chile one day, just because, I don't know, it's fun to travel.
You're trying to find Hitler?
Yeah, but I could see where people would be like, hey, we're going to put you in this card. Where am I going to fight? Chile. You'd be like, really? Like, if you're going to fight in South America, you want to fight in Brazil. Like, you don't want to go down there and fight in Peru or some shit like that. By the way, was it last week? I was telling somebody about my thing with, oh, yeah, I think it was, must have been here, about, like, Hitler and Goebbels and all them, and how, like, if they did escape down to South America,
yeah,
like, at least they haven't, like, they didn't stir up any shit. They learned their lesson. Yeah. Okay, I was telling it to somebody else. I was like, I know I've said this bit before, but where? Okay.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you don't.
Ain't gonna get fooled again.
Oh, God, that was good. That's one of my favorite. Like, that was still, like, pre, like, viral videos that it never really got as big as it should have. In other news, two fighters have been signed for Dana White's UFC Contender Series. They don't have a lot in common. One is Nick Newell, and the other is Greg Hardy. Nick Newell is the congenital amputee lightweight fighter who Has been trying to get in the UFC for years. Very good fighter, but some people think, you know, not having half your wrist and hand and arm could be dangerous in a fight. And then you've also got Greg Hardy, the former NFL lineman, who is accused of domestic assault, I guess. He apparently beat up his girlfriend and threw her around his apartment onto a pile of guns. Two very different signees, but two that'll probably garner quite a bit of attention when it comes time for their fights.
Yeah, they're going to both be in that Tuesday night contender Dana White fucking thing, whatever it is. And hey, look, I'll go out of my way to watch both of them fight.
Me too.
I can't believe Greg Hardy's already made it. Like, we've been joking about Greg Hardy for a while, and there he is. He's in the UFC, basically. Nick Newell, I mean, my first thought when I'm here, I'm like, you know, I kind of get it. And we've talked about it before about how, you know, he's good, but this is a different level and such. But then I was like, oh, you know, the optics don't always look good. Like, oh, the one-armed guy in a cage fight. But then again, I'm like, really? Who gives a shit? Like, the UFC is firmly established in the world. Like, they're not going away ever. Like, the company no longer needs to worry about, like, oh, this is going to be bad publicity for us or whatever. Like, you're getting paid hundreds of millions of dollars probably every year to do shit from networks. Like, you're fine. So, yeah, you know, Nick's a good enough fighter. Give him his shot there. And Greg Hardy, whatever. He's a big heavyweight. We need more of him. And the worst-case scenario, worst-case scenario is he keeps winning, and then he never finds any humility for beating up women. But I guess, like, a good case scenario, a likely one, is, like, he gets somewhere and we get to watch him get beat up. Because let's face it, Greg Hardy, not exactly the brightest bulb in the tool shed. I mean, if you're going to beat a woman, you don't throw her. And if you're going to throw her, you don't throw her onto a pile of guns. Like, that's, like, the last place you throw. Like, if you're beating someone up, you don't, like, you wouldn't throw a gun at them, so you shouldn't throw them at a gun. It's the same principle, dumbass.
I just thought of, like, the best meme ever. Like, after Greg Hardy gets knocked out, like, it cuts to the audience, but instead of, like, the audience of the UFC crowd, it's all the women when Oprah gives away free shit, like, cheering and going crazy.
You know who should be...
working on that now.
You should. The perfect people... I can just start talking nonstop for another hour, but the perfect people should be, like, the opposing manager, if you will, like, to, like, lead I don't want to say heel. So the antagonistic manager on the other side that's going to find somebody to beat Greg Hardy should be those annoying kids from Parkland Shooting.
Yeah. Should be. But a couple, I guess you've got two good reasons to watch Dana White's UFC Contender Series this year. A guy who wants to fight Greg Hardy is Derek Lewis. He does not like wife beaters like Travis Brown, but he already has a fight booked at UFC 226 against Francis Ngannou. This is a fight I've been talking about for a couple years that they should make, and they have finally made it, and I hope Derek Lewis knocks out Ngannou and makes fun of his age and calls him a booty scratcher, because I find it very amusing.
Yeah, look, there's one thing the world in America loves is watching two giant black men in a fight. Especially when they're like that dark black. And just like, just people like it, man. It's always been, there's always been a weird thing about, like, just, especially in MMA, you know, black on black crime. Ever since Quentin Jackson said that, just when the two brothers go at it, everybody notices. And I think it's because, like, the black guys are, like, part of, like, the same fraternity. Because, like, you know, there's so many, like, the sport is so diverse that it becomes balkanized. You got all the Brazilians, and they're in the gym, all the Brazilians are hanging out. And you got a lot of, like, white boy wrestlers and all that. Then there's a couple of black guys. Like, it's just not a lot of black guys in the sport compared to, like, you know, real sports have lots of black people doing it. MMA doesn't have that many. So when they do see each other, they're kind of like, you know, like, I'm sure it's the same thing, like, when they see each other, like, in the hall. Like, you assume, like, all the black people all can give each other a nod, like, yeah, that's right. Like, we know it's, like, Dave Chappelle talked about, like, they look at each other like, if someone's going to go down, the brothers know where each other are. And I say things like brothers because I'm cool, you know, I know how they talk. I don't actually know if they say that anymore.
I think it's funny because Derek Lewis has just been ragging on Ngannou for years, and it's like he called him an African booty scratcher. Like he's racist towards Ngannou. It's like the most amazing thing ever. It'll be a good fight because Lewis will talk a lot of shit, and I mean, there's a good chance Lewis will get knocked out because Ngannou hits so hard, but Derek Lewis has more heart than everybody else. He says it all the time, and maybe he'll pull off the win. If Lewis wins this fight, he'll be in line for a title shot, man. I mean, there's not a lot of people at heavyweight ahead of him. And, I mean, that post-fight speech when he wins the heavyweight title is going to be the greatest thing of all time. So I am looking forward to UFC 226 now.
I will tell you right now, I guarantee, I used to do a thing years ago, the five-star lock. I'm doing a five-star lock. Derek Lewis fights for the heavyweight title. He will win it if, and this is the key, if Ronda Rousey's in attendance.
Okay.
With her fine ass.
Seems unlikely. He only likes her when she's cutting weight, though. In other upcoming fights, we've got another fight on UFC Hamburg. I know you'll be excited for this one. Glover Teixeira versus Ilir Latifi.
Wow. I mean, the world just shook with excitement and anticipation.
Making her PFL debut on June 21st is Kayla Harrison. She's the two-time Olympic judo gold medalist. She's going to be cutting down to 145, which I like the sounds of because that means she can beat up Cyborg soon.
That's awesome. Yeah. I hope she better pan out, man. Plus, good for PFL, my World Series of Fighting successor that I kind of like, even though I don't really watch it if it's on, but
it's never been on.
It's got pretty production values, that's true.
It hasn't been on yet. The tournament's coming, though. I don't know.
Been a PFL. I swear I've seen a. They've had a show.
I know they did a show from DC. I don't know if it was PFL yet. They only did like three shows last year.
Didn't Jake Shields fight something? Yeah.
There was that show they did on like New Year's Eve Day.
Oh, shit. The Ultimate Fighter's on.
It is, right now.
Yeah. Oh, there's a fight.
Yeah, it's towards the end of the show, yeah. Weird. The fight's at the end of the show. Something new. What else do we have here? Oh, MMA history today. What happened 8 years ago this week? 8 years ago. That would have been 2010.
I won't remember this. That's right as law school is ending and all that stuff. I can't imagine. Although I was still in school, so I would have had a lot of free time. Although I would have maybe studying. I know what I said. I didn't have a lot of free time that summer. Is the point? So 2010.
When have you never not had free time?
When I studied for the bar.
Okay.
That's the only time in my life.
What was that, like a month?
I did about three straight months. And they were like 12, 15 hour. Like when I say 12, 15 hour days, like I would just wake up and start studying, and I would just study all day. And then, like I would have like what I call like 6 hours of real studying, but I would actually isolate myself in a library and study because I was never more afraid to fail something in my life than that fucking test. I didn't really care about like practicing law. I just didn't want to be a loser and a failure because people who did fail the test, I'm not gonna lie, I judged them. I judged the shit out of them.
Do you get a score on it, or is it just pass-fail?
Just pass-fail.
Yeah. Huh.
I wish they had a score, because I would have fucking won that shit. Oh, I worked my ass off on those tests. I was killing it. They're like, you should score something like 60 out of 100 or whatever. And I'd be like in the 90s. I'm like, I want this shit. I want to see my scores, motherfuckers. Let's go. But instead, I just finished early and started drinking.
So 8 years ago this week, it was a pay-per-view.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Okay.
Where's it from?
It's Sacramento.
Oh, the WEC pay-per-view.
Yes, the one and only WEC pay-per-view.
One of the great shows in MMA history. It's an amazing show.
It was awesome.
with one of the greatest fights of all time and an amazing main event. A great show all top to bottom. A good time had by all.
We had in the main event. Actually, Jose let's start here.
We had, no, I can go through most of it. You had Jose Aldo and Uriah Faber. You had Ben Henderson and Donald Cerrone, the Korean Zombie Leonard Garcia. And I want to say that Dustin Poirier fought on the undercard, but that made me think of somebody else. There was somebody else on the the first fight on the main card. I would say Joseph Benavidez fought.
This show's pretty crazy if you look at it now, looking back on it. On the prelim card, didn't even air on Spike. You had Brad Pickett beating Demetrius Johnson, Chad Mendez defeating Anthony Morrison, and Takeda Mizusaki defeating Ronnie Yaya. Then on the prelim card on Spike, you had Anthony.
Think about that. Brad Pickett beat Mighty Mouse.
Yeah, crazy. At bantamweight. On the Spike prelims, we had Anthony Pettis defeating Alex Karalexis, Leonard Garcia defeating Chan Sung Jung, the Korean Zombie, by split decision. And then on the main card, you had Scott Jorgensen defeating Antonio Banuelos, Shane Lowry defeating Anthony Njikawani, Manny Gambarian defeating Mike Brown, and then the two title fights. Ben Henderson beat Donald Cerrone, and Jose Aldo defeated Uriah Faber.
I forgot about Shane Roller.
Yeah. What, he was a wrestler, right? He was a
wrestler. Not from Iowa. I can't remember where he's from, but part of that Team Takedown out of Oklahoma with Johnny Hendricks and some of those guys.
And I always felt like he was flabby or something, if I'm thinking of the right guy.
He was kind of soft-looking.
Yeah. That was the fight where Aldo had all those leg kicks on Faber, and Faber's leg was just destroyed. And I felt like Faber was, like, I want to say at his peak popularity, but he was pretty over at the time. And coming out to California Love in Sacramento, and it was the first ever WEC pay-per-view, the show had just, like, a really good feel to it. And I miss WEC. Those shows were really good. They were entertaining. And I don't know what it was about WEC, but I liked it so much more than I like Bellator now. And I don't know why that is. Maybe the blue, but like Faber and Condit and even like, you know, Brian Stan and like just some of those guys who were on that show, Donald Cerrone and Benson Henderson, and they were legit fighters. And you feel like a lot of these like champions in Bellator, if they came over to UFC, they wouldn't fare as well. But like you really thought these smaller guys, they had Jose Aldo and Faber, were some of the best guys in the world in their weight class. And when they jumped to UFC, they proved it. I miss those shows. They were fun shows. They were always action-packed. And, you know, you grew to become a fan of some of those fighters just because the fights were so good. And I don't know. It's just like Bellator has never been able to kind of capture that feeling for me.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I remember thinking back then that one of the things that, like, was Strikeforce. I always thought that Strikeforce should have tried to just become the WEC, because my theory was always, look, you can't compete with the UFC for the bigger guys, but the UFC at the time had nothing below 155 pounds. In fact, for a while, there didn't even have 155 pounds. So, like, there was, like, all this real world-class talent out there that they, you know, I thought Strikeforce could have used. Instead, WEC did it. And they had just enough talent in the upper levels. They had Chael Sonnen and Brian Stan, and Paulo Fijo at one point was undefeated, and Condit, some of these other guys. So they had, like, a decent enough heavier roster, but they had just tons of outstanding lighter weight talent. And yeah, those guys all turned. I remember when they merged the company. I thought guys like Donald Cerrone, I was like, I don't know if Donald Cerrone is going to really cut it up here in the UFC. Like, I just didn't think that. Like, I thought there was still a gap there, but it turns out there wasn't as big a gap between some of the guys in WEC and the UFC.
I mean, all those guys, Pettis, Ben Henderson, they all won the UFC lightweight title. It was like Cerrone got a title shot. I mean, those three guys were really, really good. Even, who's the guy that Cerrone hated? They had a good feud in WEC.
You want to? Oh, I know who you're talking about. Jamie Varner.
Like Yeah, Jamie Fire. There's a couple low blows or something in one of their fights.
Yeah.
But he even had, like, the Showtime kick. There's just, like, a lot of classic WEC moments that, you know, I think people forget about. But those shows were great. Like, I look forward to those shows, man. And
yeah, it was sad when it went away. They only had, I think, about six of them a year or whatever. But because they had all this talent they could draw from, just every fight was good and entertaining and it had that California feel to it, and then they killed it.
And I mean, like, Uriah felt like a star. The show did 175,000 buys, which isn't great, but for a show that had never been on pay-per-view, two unknown guys to the UFC audience, and the UFC promoted it, but I don't think most UFC fans at the time knew Faber. We're still talking about a niche product with smaller guys on a lesser network that a lot of people didn't know. To do 175,000 buys is pretty impressive for, you know, Jose Aldo versus Uriah Faber, especially back in 08. I mean,
yeah.
10.
Whatever.
Yeah.
One of those two.
Anyway.
They fought in 08 also. 08 was when, with June of 08, when Uriah, no, sorry, May of 08, was previously their greatest show ever. That was when Condit beat like Mitsuhara or some Japanese guy, and the main event was Faber beating Jens Pulver.
Yeah,
and that was just an awesome show because I was in France when that show happened, and I remember just like getting really excited, and I couldn't wait to like I had to like take my shitty computer and like walk across some fucking weirdo like dorms we were in to find some faint Wi-Fi signal, and I could only like. I had to download this show in parts so I could watch this fight and that fight, and I would just watch Pulver and Faber over and over again. I had my favorite line of all time when Frank Mir is talking about how he goes, you see the way Uriah Faber's moving? He's going to use that right hand. He's going to throw the right hand, and then he's going to use it, and he's going to run off of it and get a takedown. And like 5 seconds later, that exact thing happened. Him and the other dude there's this pause, this dead silence, and you just hear Mir go, "It was a pretty good call, huh?" It was just awesome. I just loved it so much. Now it's gone.
I remember they did a good. I'm just from modern day's perspective, I almost want to call it a WEC embedded, but they did a build for that show, like an hour long show showing like Pulver training and Faber, and I remember the spin they were putting on it was Faber never lost at 145 pounds because he was coming off like getting destroyed by BJ Penn on Spike or something, so they were trying to rebuild Faber. They were showing him doing pull-ups while holding tennis balls and all this shit. Like, wow, maybe Pulver's just too small and that this he can beat Faber, and Faber just like...
Well, you remember who Pulver beat in his fight previous to that?
It was
a guillotine.
Oh, was it Cub Swanson?
It was Cub Swanson.
Yeah.
So Pulver still had, like, oddly enough, you look at it now, you go, son of a bitch, not a bad win.
Yeah. The Swanson win, I remember thinking, I'm like, I can't believe he just beat Cub Swanson. That was a long time ago. Cub Swanson is still going, huh? When was that Swanson fight? Yeah, he was coming off the knockout loss to Lozon and the rear naked choke loss to Penn, and then he beat Cub Swanson. And then after that, it was all downhill for him. He did not finish his career strong. But then he had a second fight with Faber, too, where he lost by guillotine. But anyway.
That was sad.
That was a little sad. Poor Jens Pulver. Little evil. This weekend, we've got another sad night. It's Bellator 198, Fedor versus Mir, at the Allstate Arena in Rosemont, Illinois. Will you be attending this show?
Nope.
This seems like the kind of show you would like to go to.
Yeah, no, I'm not going. I looked at it, and I thought about it, and now that the moment has arrived, I'm really glad I'm not going.
Really?
Who gives a shit? I've seen both these guys fight.
How far is this from you?
Nothing is that far from me. I mean, I could be there in half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. But you know, it's enough of a pain in the ass, and I just don't want to go.
Okay.
Sad old fucking men.
Yeah.
They're going to die.
Eventually, yes.
No, so soon.
Fedor and Frank Mir, who's actually only 38 years old. He's my age. And then Fedor, how old's Fedor now? Fedor's 41. He is coming off a loss, knockout loss to Matt Mitrione, where he did not look good. Prior to that, though, he had five straight wins, Mr. Coughlin, over Jeff Monson, Satoshi Ishii, Pedro Hizo, Jaideep Singh, and a controversial win over Fabio Maldonado, who the World Mixed Martial Arts Association still does not recognize as a win, but whatever. We'll say he won five in a row before the Mitrione loss. Maybe the Mitrione loss was just a fluke, and we're going to get the real Fedor back on Friday. Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can't wait to go to that show, huh? You don't even know what day it's on. You got the fucking computer open in front of you. That's how boring it is. Your eyes just glossed over the Wikipedia date on it just because they wanted to, like, spare your brain from even having to consider watching such a garbage fight.
That is not true. I usually think Bellator's on Friday. That's my natural inclination.
I had to think that, too. I had to figure it out. But, Fedor and his murderer's row winning streak there. I mean, what do you say about a guy that went out there and trounced the mighty Jaideep Singh? I mean, my gosh, that's right up there with winning the Pride Grand Prix, isn't it?
His opponent, Frank Mir, is 2-6 in his last eight. His two wins came over Bigfoot Silva and Todd Duffy. Most recently, he lost to Andre Arlovsky by decision, Mark Hunt by KO, and he lost to a ground kangaroo hamburger and has been on suspension for the last year and a half or so because he tested positive for... What did he test positive for? I can't find it. Some drug I would butcher anyway. So, yeah, this is part of the tournament. I believe the winner of this fight will face Chael Sonnen next.
It'll probably be Frank Mir. I'm picking Mir to win.
Isn't that pathetic?
Yeah, it is. I'm picking him to win for the best of reasons, too. He's going to win. He's going to finish him. Probably by knockout. So Frank Mir can complete the unthinkable. Because way back when, during 2005, when Frank Mir had been champion, and then he kind of, had all of his motorcycle problems and all that shit. In 2005, if you had told me that Frank Mir would be able to have wins over Nogueira, Krokop, and now Fedor to beat the big three from Pride, I can't wait to see it. Frank Mir's going to do it. He's going to be able to tell everybody for the rest of his life, Frank Mir will get to say he beat the three greatest heavyweights maybe of all time, for a while there. He's going to do it. It's just awesome.
And Brock.
And Tim Sylvia. I mean, it's a hell of a career.
And Anthony Hardonk. Fun fact, Fedor first won the Pride Heavyweight Championship in 2003, and Frank Mir won it over Tim Sylvia in 2004. So we're talking about guys who peaked 15 and 14 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing they're still fighting. No reason why an athletic commission would want to keep them out of a cage or anything like that. No. By the way, I saw on Twitter today Mike Jackson there, CM Punk's dance partner-to-be, who's out of Chicago, tweeted out that the Illinois State Athletic Commission informed him that they have a zero tolerance on marijuana. So that's cool.
That won't be a problem for Punk.
No. Although, my word, if I could ever see a man fail a drug test of any kind.
That would be something else, wouldn't it? And if you actually think about it, anybody who needs steroids more than CM Punk, I can't think of a single person. Like, if there was anyone who should be getting on the juice immediately, it's Punk.
That's the thing. Like, the only chance he'd ever have to win a cage fight is if you could somehow give him about 12 weeks of steroids and PCP, and he'd still lose. He's a piece of garbage, and I have no interest in seeing him fight. Like, I have zero interest in it. Like, I'm going to be there.
He's chasing his dream. How could you?
Yeah, fuck him and his dream. He's a little millennial bitch. Oh, I have a dream. I think I can do it. I think I can do it. Shut up. Life isn't about your dreams, asshole. Life is about waking up and dealing with misery and being a good sport about it. You straight-edge bitch.
By the way, I'm pretty sure CM Punk is part of Gen X.
Yeah, he is. But still. He's older than I am.
He was born in 78. Yeah, he's Gen X. He's definitely Gen X.
Well, he is a punk. Look, he's a man that called himself a punk. Yeah, well, I like punks, but... whatever. I should stop. Just fuck you, punk.
We can talk more about him in the coming weeks. Your semi-main event, your buddy there, Manny Sanchez, is taking on Sam Cecilia, who is apparently still alive. Who knew?
Yeah, that's, yippee.
Ah, Sam Cecilia would beat Marcus Galvao in Thackerville, Oklahoma last year. I had no idea.
Although I will say this, if you'd asked me, hey, this fight happened, if you had to guess any city in America where this fight took place, where would it be? I would have said Thackerville. Israel. That's it. That's the entire, all Bellator, it's just fucking Thackerville and Israel.
Rafael Lovato Jr. is fighting John Salter. I believe Lovato is like a world champion jiu-jitsu guy, right?
Yeah.
I know that name.
He's arguably one of the best, like, highest decorated American jiu-jitsu practitioners of all time. Really great on the ground, blah, blah, blah. He's kind of slowly eased his way into his MMA career. I've never thought he'll go far. He doesn't strike me as a hyper-athletic guy, but he's going to be a problem for people on the ground.
And I recognize John Salter. He used to fight in the UFC. I know he was kind of like a washout, but he's a decent fighter, and he's actually, on a 6-fight win streak, 5 of them in Bellator. So he's been doing okay, unbeknownst to anyone on earth. also, we've got Naaman Gracie versus Javier Torres. Gracie, I think, is like 4-5-0 in Bellator too. He is, yeah. He's undefeated at 7-0. All his fights have been in WSOF or Bellator, and he's looked good. Like all submission wins, a couple neck cranks, rear naked chokes, that sort of thing. So they're trying to build that Gracie name up any way they can, and this particular Gracie has been fairly successful in MMA.
That explains it. They're doing like a meet and greet at a T-Mobile in Chicago with Rampage and Hoyce Gracie, and I couldn't figure out why Hoyce Gracie was going to be in town. Okay, now it makes sense.
And on the opener, in his much heralded, long-awaited debut, we have Dylan Danis versus Kyle Walker. Danis is the guy who bailed Conor McGregor out of jail when he destroyed the bus with the dolly.
Hey, man, and now look at him. So, actually, by Bellator standards, that's not a bad card at all.
I like that show. I'll watch that.
I'll watch. It's not enough to get me out of the house, but I'll watch it.
Yeah, and there's no UFC this weekend, which I'm kind of surprised. This is the kind of show, like, UFC sometimes would try and compete with just to fuck with them. You know, throw something on FS1, you know, a decent card with a named fighter just to have the Bellator audience. But I guess when Bellator is only doing 200,000 viewers on a Friday night, it doesn't matter too much, does it?
No. I mean, I think they got bigger fish to fry, like taking care of Leslie Smith.
Very true. I think that's it for MMA. We're going to move on to some stuff here on MMA and stuff on halfguarded.com, if that is quite all right with you.
I don't think I have much of a say in it.
You do. You could be like, hell no, I want to talk more about the bantamweight rankings.
I like how that I don't have a choice, really, though, as far as continuing the show. I would still have to continue talking. I just would have to go back to talking about bantamweight rankings.
How do you feel about Kanye West today?
He's reinventing the known universe, man.
He's got that dragon blood.
Dude, I have no idea what the fuck's happening with the Kanye thing. Him saying that, I like the way Candace Owens thinks. I'm like, I remember Candace Owens, like, when she was, like, literally, like, a nobody. But she was like, oh, she's a cute-looking black girl who says some Republican things. But she's, like, admitted, like, I just became Republican, like, in 2016. Like, I wasn't really into politics as much. And I'm like, okay. And all of a sudden, now Kanye West likes her. And now Kanye is full-on Trump. And Chance the Rapper is saying that black people don't have to be Democrats. And I think this is the end of the Democratic Party in America, because you know, if they don't get that 90% of all the black vote going Democrat, if that gets, like, if the Republicans take a chunk out of that, the Democrats are never going to get elected again, like, ever. Like, that's just a huge base for them. And from what I hear, Kanye West is very popular in the black community.
Like, politics is so weird. Like, I've always intrigued by how people vote and why they vote, but, like, a state like Vermont, like, one of the most liberal states in the country, you've got Bernie Sanders, you don't have a single black person in Vermont, and it's like, it's just funny how, like, you think of that, like, oh, geez, if all these black people, and I get swing states and all that, it's just interesting that a state that has very few African Americans in it can swing so heavy Democrat, and then other states like Alabama or something like that, where it's heavily African American, will always vote Republican. It just, like, some of the theories and ideas behind voting and stuff, they're not consistent by any means, and it's just, like, I find that sort of thing super, super interesting.
Yeah, like, I remember hearing somebody say once that, like, you rarely hear Bernie Sanders be super outspoken on guns. Because I guess guns are very popular in Vermont, which,
right.
I don't know why, but it makes sense. I feel like people in Vermont would like guns because they're all hunting or some shit like that. But there's still a bunch of, like, you know, limp-wristed pansy liberal types out there with their maple syrup and all that. So it's a state, Vermont, I guess. I don't really know why it's a state, but I guess we're glad we have it.
Well, I was just thinking of, like, the alternative to what you were saying, and it's like there's always, like, outliers and stuff that doesn't really quite make sense, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, I see that shit all the time. It's like, again, we're living in an age where, like, Milo Yiannopoulos was considered a Nazi and Kanye West is a Republican. Like, what? What is the flamboyant homosexual that only dates black men and who's Jewish is a Nazi, and the black guy is, like, not just like, oh, I think Trump's cool. Like, Kanye's, like, all in, and it's clear this isn't him screwing around because Kim Kardashian's tweeting about it. Like, you just know Kanye's talking at the dinner table about this stuff, and he's all in, and Caitlyn Jenner is probably the responsible for this because that's Kanye's mother-in-law somehow, I think. I'm not sure. I think that's how it is, right? So, I don't know, man. The world's so awesome right now, though.
Kanye, it's funny, he hadn't tweeted for a long time, and then he started promoting, he's got a couple albums he produced that are coming out in, like, the next few weeks, and then he started talking some politics, and it just seemed to catch fire. He's talking about Peter Thiel, and just all these different people, and it's getting all these likes and all this attention, and I mean, Kanye's definitely wacky, but he's not dumb by any stretch. And I don't know what his political beliefs are. I don't really care either way, but he's getting a lot of press before these new albums come out.
Yeah, and that's probably a lot of it here, if I had to guess. The thing is, again, it's Kanye. Like, it's not, like, just anyone. Like, this is almost like, it's kind of like Oprah. If, like, Oprah said she liked Trump, there'd be a lot of people who'd be like, oh, shit, That's a real, and especially when Chance the Rapper kind of comes out, and not that he like supported Trump, but all of a sudden it's just like, wait, what's going on here? And I think people are going to overstate the importance of this. I think the news cycles these days move so fast that we will forget about, like, by the time June comes around, we'll look at it and go, hey, remember when Kanye was a Trump supporter? We'll be like, oh yeah, that was 15 news cycles ago. We've already done 3 nuclear wars since then. But I do think there's some value if you're the Republican Party as far as, obviously, look, when 90% of black people vote for the Democrats, that's not like a normal number. That's a comedically high. That's that's Iraq Saddam Hussein shit. People just roll their eyes like, yeah, whatever. But a lot of this, you know, this they you vote, you get used to it, whatever. Somebody like Kanye comes along, and suddenly there's going to just be enough people out there like going, I guess I could be Republican. Like, that is kind of cool, because it's Kanye. Like, he's a trendsetter, tastemaker, whatever. Like, he's there. He's not there. He's like, people love him and all. That all said, yeah. I want to caution people, remind everyone, still named his kid North. Like, he named his kid Northwest, for fuck's sake. Let's not really give a shit at all what Kanye does. I know the Republicans are all in, because the GOP has a really shallow celebrity bench, but Kanye's a moron. Like, and he's a weirdo. And he came out there and said, you know, George Bush hates black people, and we all remember that still. Like, I don't think Kanye. I don't know what goes through Kanye's head, but he's talented. I'll give him that.
He's good at making records. I agree. I like a lot of his stuff, but I also do think he's kind of a joke, and I think that eccentric might be a good word for him. I think some of the fame, and I even hear stories about him when he was like coming up in the rap scene, and it's just like he's always been a weird dude, and you know he's a great musician and like will make his own beats and produce all this shit and produce hit records, and a lot of those guys throughout, you know, pop music and history have been eccentric weirdos, the most successful guys, whether it's Michael Jackson or Prince or whoever. And you don't know if they were weird before the fame or if the fame made them weird or what the situation is, but usually, I don't want to say geniuses, but sometimes somebody who's a genius has a couple screws loose in other ways, you know? And Kanye might be one of those guys.
I think it's essentially a requirement to be a genius.
Yeah,
maybe. It's just, being part of being a genius is you see the world in a different way, and you're going to be a genius in some stuff, but that also means you're like, you're the person that's like, I think I can go through a red light. Why not? I can do what I want. Like, because it worked out when you said, like, I think I can mix this album with that album. I don't know if Kanye speeds a lot or blows red lights. It's kind of a really weird example, but I mean, honestly, when Kanye was doing all this, it was just kind of funny. But when I saw Chance the Rapper kind of come out, again, I don't think Chance is saying vote Republican, but when he said something, I was like, just because, like, in my brain, Chance is the social, he's a very woke, kind of like, people are like, is he going to run for mayor in Chicago? And, like, and I never thought it was, like, really serious, but it was, like, people talked about it serious enough, I'm like, okay, he's got to be the Ta-Nehisi Coates type, where you're like, oh, he's the intellectual guy. I'm like, wait, something weird's going on. Then you got the Killer Mike, likes the NRA, and it's just weird. Like, the world, well, like, plus, it's Donald Trump. It's a joke that all these, like, Eminem and all these guys all came out against Trump, because I'm like, until 2016, Donald Trump was, like, the idol of the rappers. He's everything they ever wanted to be was Donald Trump.
Yeah, when they didn't know his politics, too, when he was just a TV star, yeah. But I don't want to say that this has any effect on it, because obviously I'm in a weird bubble. But some of these, you know, Jordan Petersons and Sam Harris and Joe Rogan, and I don't want to say these guys talking about tribalism and all that stuff. Maybe some of that's starting to catch on, and people are like, whoa, wait a minute. We all don't have to agree on everything all the time. And, like, to me, that's a good thing. Like, Kanye coming out and saying stuff and getting people to think a little more and not, you know, just follow the Pied Piper or the lemons off the cliff is probably a good thing. And I think some of that might be seeping into more and more mainstream culture now.
Yeah, I mean, I've been of the belief that we're going to, that it feels like America is really becoming from two parties to four. Because, like, there's been a really weird fucking, like, psychotic liberal thing that, like, these leftists would, like, just all of a sudden, it just comes out of nowhere where, like, people are getting shouted down and they're threatening people and, like, they're demanding that you use new pronouns and shit. And everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, you know, a lot of Democrats are like, wait, what? Nah, I'm not down with that yet. And then, like, obviously Republicans are in this weird thing where Donald Trump is there, and like, he's exposing a lot of, like, I was the populist nativist roots within Republicanism, but he's clearly not a conservative at all. And so now you're seeing, like, the conservatives, but also, like, the old-timey rich dude white guy Republicans, and it feels like there's kind of, like, these two extremes and two centers, and you're seeing guys like Kanye. And, like, I've heard, like, Dave Rubin, and I think it was actually, it may have been Dr. Drew called themselves, like, the extreme center or something like that, like the hard center. It seems like there's a lot of people out there who are really just saying, like, they're being overly proud of saying, I'm reasonable. Like, their thing is, I'm going to purposely take positions from both sides, and I don't even think these people always believe it so much as this. Their gimmick is, I want to be in the middle. Is their way of rebelling against the wings. And somehow Kanye West is now part of this. I don't know how, but he is.
He had a series of tweets that cracked me up a couple days ago. He wrote, I really love my Tesla. I'm in the future. Thank you, Elon. I heard these are really good for the environment. I'm super charged. About to take this whole thing to Mars. This is the funnest car I've ever driven. We're evolving at warp speed. Like, Kanye's making it sound like Elon Musk gave him a Tesla and he had no idea what it was. Or the fact, it's like, I heard these are good for the environment. Like, what the hell?
Well, that's how some of this, all of Kanye's tweets read like he's just stoned out of his mind. Like, everything. These cars, I'm feeling like I'm in the future. Because, it's weird. It seems to me, like, honestly, what's happened is, like, Kanye's gone to San Francisco for the first time. Like, he's visited Silicon Valley. And he's, like, seeing all these, like, tech things going, oh, shit, this is the future. And in his brain, I think it must be like, oh, new ways of thinking. Okay, what's a new way of thinking? Republic Trump, man. That's different, right? Okay, that's about, I think, as deep as Kanye West has probably gotten with any of this.
I honestly think it's more just to hype up his upcoming albums, but that's just my cynical self. He's very good at making news, whether it's with Taylor Swift or George Bush doesn't care about black people. He always finds a way to do it. So watch for his albums to drop in the next month. In other Trump news, he said Saturday that he is considering granting a pardon to boxer Jack Johnson on the advice of actor Sylvester Stallone. Stallone called
because that's a sentence that makes total sense in this day and age. In 2018, things like Sylvester Stallone recommended a presidential pardon, and it was considered with great thought and care. That happened.
Trump wrote on Twitter, of course, Stallone called me with the story of heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson. His trials and tribulations were great. His life complex and controversial. Others have looked at this over the years. Most thought it would be done, but yes, I am considering a full pardon. Capitalized.
Everything about Trump is
exclamation point.
I love that everything Trump says anywhere, it's always in compare. It's never about. It's not always about what he does. There's always though an element of somebody else didn't do it. You know, others throughout the years have looked at this, but they didn't do it. You know, who makes him think, hey, I'm doing this. We wouldn't have had to do this if Obama did it properly. Like, he always references someone else failing when he succeeds.
Jack Johnson was the first African-American world heavyweight boxing champion. He was convicted in 1913 under the Mann Act for taking his white girlfriend across state lines for immoral purposes. The Mann Act purported to prevent human trafficking for the purpose of prostitution, but critics have argued it was applied inconsistently to criminalize African Americans and those with dissenting political views.
Doesn't sound like anything that would happen to black people.
Johnson was what the hell's her name? The chick that Kanye was talking about. She would disagree with that.
Completely. Candace Owens, yeah.
Thank you, Candace Owens. She would say, that's bullshit. Johnson was convicted by an all-white jury in less than 2 hours and was imprisoned for a year. The sentence and imprisonment destroyed the boxing career of the Galveston Giant. He died in 1946. So, essentially, I think over the last, you know, last couple decades, several senators and congressmen have tried to get him pardoned and written to the White House, but Obama didn't do it for whatever reason, and they're trying again this year, I guess.
I wonder who's against it. Like, there must be somebody saying don't do it, because otherwise somebody would tell me. Because the way the world works is somebody says, "Hey, you should do this," and if nobody says don't do it, then it gets done. Because somebody goes, you know, if somebody says, "You know what we should do? We should have a motorized horse and buggy." And then you go, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do it. But if somebody said, no, that's a bad idea because of we don't have airbags, you'd be like, okay. Like, but nobody, there's got to be somebody saying, don't pardon Jack Johnson after the fact. Because otherwise you would just do it because it's, you're only going to get good PR. So why let it sit there? Then again, there haven't really actually been that many presidents to actually try to do this, really. You know, I mean there have been, but we're only talking probably about, what, 6 or 7 people that really had to make this decision, so. And most of them are racist, so.
I'm
like, LBJ wasn't going to pardon Jack Johnson. I mean.
The campaign to grant Johnson a pardon began back in 2004 with high-profile supporters like Harry Reid and John McCain, but it really gained steam early in the Obama years when the resolution passed through Congress in 2009. And yet Obama never acted, neither then nor when the pardon push reemerged in 2013, nor during his last year in office when it reemerged once more. It befuddled all of us, said one congressional aide involved in the push. We couldn't for the life of us understand why he didn't do anything or the administration didn't.
Because Obama's not a brother. You know, he's a white liberal at heart, man. He didn't care about this stuff, but Trump, at heart, he's a brother. I am just saying brother today. I'm all about it.
Gavin Park, a former senior leadership staffer for Reid, said, reading between the lines, our conjecture was that they didn't want to engage in divisive racial issues that were largely symbolic. But the main reason that Obama held back, Park added, was out of a rigid dedication to preserving norms. The Obama White House was stringently opposed to the pardons process becoming politicized in any way. They felt so strongly about that it may have extended even to posthumous. Thank you, pardons. Getting very parched here. I'm out of coffee. Such a position seems as one Obama veteran conceded quaint in the Trump years, but it was a thing. This one senior official who asked to speak on background not to characterize the president's thinking put it, President Obama relied on the Department of Justice to make recommendations and is against the DOJ's general policy to accept these types of pardons. So there you go.
Yeah, that's always a real good bullshit line. Like, hey, why didn't the other guy do it? You know what? He was just so ethical and honest about these things that he couldn't bring himself to do it. As opposed to the truth, which is somebody just dropped the ball. You know, that's it. Because otherwise we can say, if Trump doesn't do it, it's just because he's a racist or something. Even though this is absolute, this is so perfect for Donald Trump.
It totally is.
This is what he was made to be president to do.
Well, it's also like, if Obama didn't do it, I'll do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's totally his thing. Oh yeah, Obama was too much of a pussy, I'll do it, I don't care. Like, he doesn't even know who he's never even heard of Jack Johnson. Like, who are we kidding?
He might have. He's really old.
He hasn't heard of Jack Johnson. He died in 1946.
No, but Trump has spent so much time around casinos in the fight game. He may have heard the name. Look, I bet if you ask him about Jack Johnson, he'll tell you all about him. I bet he knows all about Jack Johnson. If you ask Donald Trump, very few people know as much about Jack Johnson as Donald Trump does.
I'm the best at Jack Johnson. Tennis is facing a tsunami of integrity problems, according to a 2-year investigation into corruption within the sport. The independent review panel was commissioned in February 2016 after a BBC investigation uncovered suspected illegal betting on the eve of that year's Australian Open. The investigation, led by sports law expert Adam Lewis, has interviewed more than 1,000 people from across the sport and is thought to have cost close to $28 million to fund. Findings state that the biggest problems lie in lower levels of the game on the futures tour due to the low prize money providing an incentive for players to match fix for financial reward. Only the top 250 to 350 players earn enough money to break even, yet there are nominally 15,000 or so professional players. The imbalance between prize money and the cost of competing places players in an invidious position by tempting them to contrive matches for financial reward. Players may be particularly tempted in relation to matches that they intended to tank for unrelated reasons, a factor that has been aptly described as the seeds of corruption, or matches that they believe they can win even while contriving to lose game sets or points along the way. So essentially,
who gives a shit?
Well, that's one thing, but basically these lower level players will basically do what was his name? Tai Hung Bang or whatever was going to do in that South Korean fight. It's a lower level thing. You're only making 10, 15 grand for a fight, and somebody's offering you 100 grand to throw it. You're like, huh, that's worth about my entire career the way it's going right now? What the hell? And maybe nobody will notice, and I lose by decision, and I still get to keep my contract. In tennis, there's less money than that, and less people paying attention to it. So I guess all these guys, like, on the futures tours, which is, like, one step below, like, the ATP, they're trying to get into these major tournaments, the bigger ones, will just throw matches with the idea that somebody's going to bet heavy on it and give them a piece of the action.
Look, I understand, like, you want to protect the integrity of your actual sport, like the 300 ATP people, whatever. That's like, you know, because when you make your money off of, you know, people believing that they're watching the best actually do this. But like 15,000, like, that's just everybody that plays tennis. Like, how many people really could be playing tennis out there? And oh yeah, it's like some guy in Thackerville, Oklahoma, throwing a tennis match. Who gives a shit? The only people in the world that could possibly care are the people betting on it. That's it.
How many people, like, can that be?
Yeah, but really, the only people betting on that, on a tennis match that obscure, are people fixing the match itself. It's got to be some sort of money laundering scam or something. Because, like, there's not even a crowd for these people. Like, seriously. Like,
right.
We're talking tennis players who are probably low enough that, like, when they compete, their wife doesn't show up. He's like, he's just out for the afternoon. You know, he'll be back later in time to barbecue or something like that. Like, come on.
The Tennis Integrity Unit received 38 alerts from betting companies of potentially suspicious matches during the first quarter of 2018. Of those, one was from the ATP Tour and one from the WTA Tour, while 23 were from the ITF Future Tours. I don't know what this will lead to, but I always find betting on sports and conspiracies and illegal gambling to be fun to talk about.
Just get a life, people, or something. Again, it's not like, I understand, you know, I can see like a big high-profile thing, because like the average person, like anything like a regular person could get fucked over by this, I would be, okay, stop it, that's bullshit, look into it. But again, like we just said, there's no normal people betting on this. I don't think I'm going to Vegas and putting down $500 on the, you know, number 14,312 in the world playing tennis. They would look at me and just laugh. Like you couldn't make that kind of bet. You couldn't find someone to make a bet like that. Your family wouldn't bet with you on that. The Williams sisters wouldn't know who the fuck these people are with enough confidence to bet on it. Why do you even allow bets? That's what you have to do. Just don't allow bets. I guess they can't stop that in certain countries, can they? Fucking, it's all Europeans and Asians. Huh. Not Americans.
WWE has gotten a restraining order against a poop-smearing fan.
Well, if you're ever going to get a restraining order against somebody, it's the guy that is known as the poop-smearing fan. Let's face it, if you're a fan of pro wrestling to begin with, you're not going to be held in high esteem in society. And when the known descriptor of you is poop-smearing, you're definitely not going to be contributing much.
TMZ Sports has obtained court documents showing Vince McMahon's company had a very real fear of Armando Alejandro Montalvo, who's allegedly been harassing the company since 2015. According to the court docs, Montalvo smeared his own feces all over the walls at the WWE Training Center in Orlando back in July 2015. He continued his bizarre campaign against the company in the following days, wearing makeshift wrestling costumes, banging on the doors, and threatening staffers. On at least one occasion, he was subdued by cops at gunpoint. In March 2018, Montalvo...
Oh, I can't remember this guy.
Yeah. In March 2018, Montalvo again surfaced at a WWE event venue in Florida and began harassing employees, screaming, "My new wrestling nickname is Generation Flex because my dick and my balls is bigger than Generation X."
So basically, WWE came face to face as one of their regular fans and panicked. This guy with the poop smearing, I'll admit, is a little weird. Everything else just sounds like a wrestling, but everything else just sounds like a wrestling fan. Like seriously,
yeah.
Just some socially awkward fat guy I imagine showing up at the training center. I got my wrestling name and my gimmick, and I even have my own belt. So I'm ready to go, and not knowing how to take a hint. Just again, we're talking the lowest rung of society here. Like these are some real rejects.
WWE says they learned Montalvo posted an Instagram message on April 4th cryptically threatening WWE wrestlers and staff and rushed to court to get an immediate restraining order against him because they fear he's a serious threat. WWE says Montalvo has also threatened to use his own semen in a biological attack. Court records show the restraining order was granted. Still, Montalvo continues to post videos on social media harassing WWE wrestlers.
I like that there is apparently in the world of crazy a hierarchy of bodily fluids. Like you start with one and you go, if you don't come around, I got a gallon of jizz in the back that I'm just gonna fucking fire off at you motherfuckers. And if you're WWE apparently hears this and they actually had to tell a judge, Your Honor, he smeared feces. Now he's threatening semen and the judge is gonna react with, whoa. He's going, it's like a fucking chemical weapon attack in Syria. Like, there's just, that's a red line. We cannot let this go unchallenged.
It's not a pleasant thought.
Nah, he's a winner. I don't totally blame the guy either, because about 20, 30 years ago, if you did shit like that, that's how you got in the business. There's a lot of guys talking about, like, how'd you get into pro wrestling? I hung around for a long time, and then eventually they made me a wrestler.
I was curious to get your thoughts on this story. Police use dead man's finger in failed bid to unlock his cell phone. Did you hear about this one?
No, but it sounds like a good idea.
Police officers in the city of Largo tried to gain access to the cell phone of the late Linus Phillip by pressing his fingers against the fingerprint sensor. They failed, but the move outraged his fiancée. "I just feel so disrespected and violated," she said. Phillip, 30, was shot and killed on March 23rd after he tried to flee a Largo police officer who smelled marijuana wafting from his car and was trying to search him. According to the state attorney's office for Pinellas and Pasco counties, Phillip was unarmed. His body was released to his loved ones.
Is he black?
I haven't seen. You would.
Wait, hold on.
Okay.
Smelled of marijuana, unarmed, shot by the cops. Of course he's black.
His body was released to his two loved ones at some point before March 26, when two Largo detectives showed up at the Sylvan Abbey funeral home in Clearwater, Florida, with Phillip's phone. Cheney told the Tampa Bay Times that police wanted to access and preserve data on the phone to aid in the investigation into Phillip's death and separate inquiry into a drug case involving Phillip. This was witnessed by workers at the funeral home. The fiancé has filed a complaint against the detectives who gave Armstrong their business cards while at the funeral home. She said they are considering suing the city of Largo for unwarranted search and seizure and obtaining illegal access to the body after it left police custody. What do you say, Michael Coughlin? Can you try and hack into a dead person's cell phone using their own finger, unbeknownst to the family?
I don't know about that legally.
It seems bad. It seems wrong to me.
It's a
Are you
weird
supposed to,
one?
Like, not fuck with dead people's bodies and shit?
Oh, well, yeah, but, I mean, this is not like they're fucking it. You know, they're not molesting it. They're trying to, you know, use it for a police investigation. You know, they collect hair and DNA samples and shit from dead bodies. It's just pressing his finger on a phone. I'm kind of surprised it didn't work. Like,
but
why?
I don't know. What happens to your cell phone after you die? Do people, can the authorities access it? Do they have right to do that, or is it private?
Well, it's not about the right to do it so much as the practical reality that they can't, because the encryption's so good. We saw Apple having that problem where, you know, the government wanted them to turn over the unlock the phones, and Apple's like, we can't do it. Like, we designed it so we can't do it. No, I think they're full of shit and lying. I bet, you know, not Steve Jobs, whoever the next, the gay one, Tim Cook, I bet, you know, he's got a way to look at all of our shit. But nonetheless, like, that's the real issue. They'd have the legal. I would. Cell phones are so weird. They're tricky just because of what they are and all the data contained within, all the information. I mean, normally, like, if it's on the guy's person, is he's running away from the cops to get shot and part of all that stuff, like, you can always search the body, and anything on there is fair game, and it's how it should be fair game. So, yeah, I think they'd be able to search it, but I just don't know how they can do it.
Charles Rose, a professor at the Stetson University College of Law in Florida, said Phillip's loved ones may not have a legal leg to stand on. He said warrants are designed to protect citizens against unreasonable searches under the Fourth Amendment. Given that the owner of the phone is dead, he no longer has a privacy right to assert under the Fourth Amendment. It's an open question as to whether his family might have that right, but he does not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think... Again, it's really a weird one because it's a weird one for a bunch of, like, legal dorky reasons. There's nothing all that interesting, I think, to the general public beyond kind of weird that they couldn't do this before they dropped the body off. Like, they it's not like the body goes directly to the funeral home. It's got to go to the morgue in the corner. And there's steps there. Like, and there's definitely steps before the family gets involved, especially if he's been shot by a cop. You shouldn't just be like, yeah, a couple days later, somebody should go, you know, I got an idea. I think we can get this phone open. Why don't we just dig them up? But that'll work. Yeah.
It's been cold out. He's probably been fairly well preserved. Well, first of all, they screwed up and shot a guy who was running away from him who was unarmed. So that's the first screw up.
Sure.
Then they wait several days to try and hack into his cell phone with his finger. It's like... not the best.
Also, I like one of the excuses they gave. So I'm like, because it could lead to information on another case, And I think that this says something like, and also like in this current case with this guy, it's like, in other words, somebody's like, hey, you know, we shot this guy because we said he had marijuana. Maybe we should go through his phone and see if we have any proof of this. Otherwise, we just murdered a guy.
And in a follow-up to one of my favorite stories we've done here on MMA and stuff, a Texas man has been sentenced to 50 years in prison for stealing $1.2 million worth of fajitas over 9 years.
I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah, we did. We talked about this months ago. Essentially, this guy was working at a school. I don't know if he was a custodian or I think he worked in the cafeteria. And essentially, like, you know, every month he would order fajitas, and he was essentially stealing them from the school and selling them elsewhere. And he missed work one day, and the school got a delivery for, like, I don't even know, 800 pounds of fajitas. And he was off, and somebody saw, like, we don't, we've never served fajitas here ever. It was like a juvenile correctional facility, that sort
there
of thing.
You know, yeah.
And he got busted, and he got fired. And now he's been found guilty of stealing $1.2 million worth of fajitas and has been sentenced to 50 years in prison. That's what he was sentenced to. 50 years
yeah, I mean,
for fajitas.
When I saw this that sentence, I thought, if there's got to be more to this, it's like, nope. Like, they gave him a harsh fucking sentence. And I guess one of the things they could do is, like, a mitigating factor is because he's, like, a public official that broke the public's trust. It's like, you know, he stole from the people, so you get punished extra harsh and blah, blah, blah. Which, like, that's what, like, look, that's a great thing if you're the mayor or somebody, but if you're just a dipshit that your job entails ordering fajitas, like, seriously, if that's the amount of authority you have in life is that you order fajitas, you should get 50 years in jail. Yeah, he cheated. He definitely broke the law. But when he kind of said something like, you know, it just kind of started small and kind of got out of control, it's like, yeah, I totally see how that happens. You know, you steal, you get a couple fajitas, and next thing you know, a little becomes a little, and a little one do it, and a little got more and more, and then you got fajitas coming out your ass.
53-year-old Gilberto Escamilla was sentenced Friday after pleading guilty to theft by a public servant. The Brownsville Herald reports he told the court the fajita scheme spun out of control. Escamilla had been intercepting fajitas that he ordered through the Cameron County Juvenile Center.
You realize this is a story where the guy whose name is Escamilla, he's stealing fajitas, and they are in Brownsville. Like, this story is really on the nose.
I don't get how you get 50 years for that. Because
he's brown.
I know, but it just seems so wrong to me when you hear these other cases where it's like manslaughter and they get a couple years, or John Jones is out wasted and almost kills a pregnant woman and nothing happens. Just like, yeah, he stole, he should get a punishment, I get it, but his life's over now. You know what I mean? Like, it's just harsh.
Yeah, I mean, 50 years is like, to me, I mean, let's face it, murder is 20 to life. We start at 20. They don't start at 50 to life, and that's murder. This feels like, again, it's a white-collar crime. And people will go to jail for white-collar crimes. You know, especially don't go to 50 years in jail. And if you do, it's because you're an Enron-level thing. Not, come on, this poor son of a bitch, you can't send a man to jail and let the other inmates know he's in there for the rest of his life for stealing fajitas. They're going to kill him. Like, this is the dumbest thing in the world to go to jail for. You stole fajitas. And it's a lot. I don't feel like 5-10 years. You know, that's enough.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to fuck around. Like, nobody's going to risk stealing fajitas for 10 years in jail. But, you know, that's enough of a deterrent.
Yeah, I'm not going to steal fajitas. I've come to that conclusion.
The delicious irony is that the fajita is a Mexican dish that Americans have popularized, just like prison. We've gotten really good at taking Mexicans and enclosing them in our prisons.
That is true. I feel bad.
They don't have a lot of prisons in Mexico.
I feel bad for this guy. Anyway, that's all I've got for MMA and stuff this week. Is there anything you would like to add, Mr. Coughlin?
Suck my balls, Facebook.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. MMA and stuff, halfguarded.com. Catch you next time.
Get up, cocksuckers. It's all over. Listen, we had a rough couple of months. Fucking Katrina's cousin Maria. The other one, Puerto Rico, Houston, fucking Florida. Listen, it's been tough up to now. The earthquake in Mexico. The White House, whoever the fuck is going on. But it don't matter. They want to shoot. It's time for us to fucking shoot, cocksuckers. They want to get down and dirty. Don't forget who the fuck we are. You understand me? We're the baddest motherfuckers out there. You send a message to that fucking North Korean, he's going to be sniffing my dick and sucking my asshole. That's the focus. We're going to North Korea in like a year. It's going to be an island. It's going to glow in the dark. You know why? Because we're Americans, cocksuckers. Who the fuck do you think you're dealing with? Stop with the gun control. They're selling more guns than ever the last 3 days. Stop with the fucking whining. Stop with the Russians on Facebook. I don't give a fuck. Worry about yourself. Keep your eyes open. And get the fuck off Snapchat and fucking Twitter, cocksucker. Stay black.